The following Dharma discourse was given by Jeffrey Shugen Arnold at Zen Mountain Monastery. Shugen Roshi is the head of the Mountains and Rivers Order and abbot of the monastery. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you would like to make a donation or find out more about our various programs, visit us online at zmm.org. Thank you for listening.
By Zhang and the Fox, the main case. Whenever Master Baijiang gave Taisho on Zen, an old priest sat with the monks to listen and always withdrew when they did. One day, however, he remained behind. Baijiang said, "Who are you standing here before me?" The priest said, "I'm not a human being. In the past, in the time of Kashyap Buddha, I was the head of this monastery. And once a monk asked me, 'Does an enlightened person fall into causation or not?' And I replied, 'They do not. Because of this answer, I was made to live as a fox for 500 lives. Now I beg you, please say a turning word on my behalf and release me from this fox body.'" The priest then asked Baijiang, "Does an enlightened person fall into causation or not?" Baijiang said, "They do not ignore causation." Hearing this, the old priest was at once enlightened. Making a bow to Baijiang, he said, "I have now been released from the fox body, which will be found behind the mountain. I dare to make a request of the master. Please bury it as you would a deceased monk." Baijiang had the Eno strike the gavel and announced to the monks that there would be a funeral for a deceased monk after the midday meal. The monks wondered aloud, saying, "We're all in good health. There's no sick monk here. What is this all about?" After the meal, the master led the monks to a rock behind the mountain, poked out a dead fox with a staff, and cremated it. In the evening, the master ascended the rostrum in the hall and told the monks the whole story. Wang Po thereupon said, "This old priest failed to give the correct turning words and was made to live as a fox for 500 lives, you say. If, however, their answer had not been incorrect each time, what would they have become?" Baijiang said, "Come here and I'll tell you." Wang Po then stepped forward to Baijiang and slapped him. Baijiang laughed out loud, clapping his hands, and said, "I thought the foreigner's beard was red, but I see that it's a foreigner with a red beard." Women's commentary. Not falling into causation. Why were they turned into a fox? Not ignoring causation. Why were they released from the fox body? If you have an eye to see through this, then you'll know that the former head of the monastery did indeed enjoy their 500 happy, blessed lives as a fox. Woman's poem. Not falling, not ignoring, odd and even are on one die. Not ignoring, not falling, hundreds and thousands of regrets. You know, the nice thing about having the opportunity to give talks on these koans is that they keep opening up, revealing. So this is from the woman koan. The other day I took it from the Book of Serenity. And so they're slightly different, same basic story. And so this question or this matter, causation, the Buddha said it is essential that we study it, examine it, understand it, have faith in it. I read from Dogen, who was very clear, unambiguous about the importance of having deep faith in causation. And he's, you know, teachers don't really ever say anything new. In a sense, that's the point, right? It's sort of antithetical to our time where, you know, even if you're just a tube of toothpaste, you have to come out with something new every few months. Really, the responsibility of the teachings, a teacher, is to be true to the Dharma that has come down. Yes, of course, each person speaks about it in their own way, and there's a newness, a freshness to that. But the Dharma itself, it does not need improvement, in a sense, or innovation. Nagarjuna said, if you deny cause and effect in the worldly realm, as some people outside the way do, you negate this present life as well as future lives. If you deny cause and effect in the realm of practice, you reject the three treasures and the four noble truths. Which means, in a worldly sense, it will be hard to live. Within Buddha Dharma, it will be very hard to practice. Cause and effect. One clearly seems to lead to the other. And in that, there's apparent duality. And the teachings speak about there is cause, there is effect. One of the images or metaphors it uses of a seed, that when the seed sprouts and begins to send down roots and send up leaves and branches, it's no longer a seed. That the causal relationship is there, but the seed is no longer existent. It's now there is no seed, there's a sprout. Master Dogen in the Genjo Koan said, firewood turns to ash and does not turn into firewood again. If you think of this in terms of cause and effect, but do not suppose that the ash is after and the firewood before. We must realize that firewood is in the state of being firewood. The cause is in the state of being cause and has its own before and after. Yet having before and after, it is independent of them. It is a complete moment, a complete entity, without any fixedness, without any solidity, without any self. Ash is in the state of being ash, Dogen says, and has its before and after. Just as firewood does not become firewood again, after it is ash, so after one's death, one does not return to life again. So we cannot go back to the cause. We cannot go back to anything. If you just had the most splendid period of Zazen, kiss it goodbye. Right? It's already gone. You cannot keep it. Why would you want to? In a sense, keeping it might presume that this is it. This is what there is. This is as deep, as broad, as insightful, as important as it is. And wanting to get away quickly from what a difficult period of Zazen is also presuming that there is something wrong with that, that that has nothing to offer. There is no intrinsic good or bad, right or wrong. There is no intrinsic nature to anything. That's what the Buddha realized. Everything, all of us, animate, inanimate. As the Buddha said, within the human realm, whether we speak of it as a state of becoming, I find that a little problematic because it's as though it is becoming something, but it is always becoming, so it never arrives. It's sometimes also spoken of as process. I don't know, it sounds a little bit like being on an assembly line. You know, I don't know what the right way of speaking of it is. But the point is, it's alive. And so the Buddha said, in this moment, you are having an experience. You're experiencing this because of causation, causal actions, and results that are bringing you to this experience to your awareness in this moment. It doesn't belong to you. You can't keep it. It is not you. He said it is only to be experienced. Hear only what is heard. See only what is seen. Everything is empty of its own power, its own being, its own origination, and yet we're deeply affected by things. That's our sentience. It's a good thing, right? What if we were like, I mean, maybe stones are affected. They certainly do change. We don't know what they feel. We feel. Would you want to not? Maybe sometimes, but don't wish on that. So it's how do we hold this sentience? How do we hold this feeling, sensing, perceiving, body and mind? A word is spoken and you feel love, trust, inspiration. A word is spoken and you get angry, distrustful, or feel helpless. We are affected by actions. That's why actions are important. The Buddha recognizes how powerful language is. He said, know what you're going to say before you say it. Think about its influence. Where is it coming from? Does it need to be said? Is it helping? The effects we experience, that can seem short, that can seem long. People can carry the consequences of actions their entire lives. Maybe you know some who have. And usually there's a point at which there's an investment in not putting that down. We can carry guilt and remorse. We can carry anger and resentment. That's why forgiveness is so important. Forgiveness is the ability to forsake your right to carry that grudge. You can. It's your right. Nobody can take that away from you. But you forsake that right. For what? For why? And the beauty of that is you can forgive someone who isn't asking for your forgiveness. We can apologize to somebody meaningfully, deeply, and they not accept it. But no one can prevent us from offering that. We don't have to wait for someone's request to forgive. A realized being does not fall into cause and effect and was made to live 500 years as a fox. So as I said the other day, seems pretty clear to be punishment. That's an ordinary way of looking at it. In the moment of firewood, there is only the state of firewood, being firewood. In the moment of a cause, there's only that state of a cause. Because nothing is fixed, everything is not only subject to change, is changing. Habits are either getting stronger or getting weaker. Views that we hold are either becoming more entrenched or not. I remember years ago, there was somebody in residence. No, they weren't in residence. They'd been in residence. They were living nearby. I was seeing them in Doksan, and they said they were in a corporate job that they hated. I mean, they spoke about it with, like, I could feel the hate. And every day she had to go in for this job because she had signed a contract. She had 3 months left. She had already secured a new position, which she was very excited about, and which made the 3 months still in this job even harder. And she was a practitioner. And I said, what if you don't make it to the end of these 3 months? What if you die before that happens? And I said, you made an agreement to give them your best. You've got 3 months left. Is this helping you actively hating this? How can you practice this? I said, until those 3 months are over, this is the rest of your life. If you think of it that way, there is no after. There is no next. This is it. I remember talking to one of our incarcerated students who had been up for parole countless times. And because of the nature of his crime, he was probably never going to be released. And every time 2 years would come around, he would get so enthused and do so much work and work so hard and garner so much support to be released, and then it would be denied. And he would just be crushed. and fall into a depression, and then he would rouse again. And I'd witness this over many years. And finally, one day I said to him, I said, look, why don't you work hard towards being paroled, but imagine that you are never leaving this place. And he looked at me like, well, you can imagine how he looked at me. He did not hear these as words to be heard, as something to consider. And I understood. I got that. But it was the clutching, the investment, the attachment to the result that he wanted, and many thought rightfully deserved, that was keeping him alive. And I said, but it's also killing you. Is there another way? There's a koan where a great ox, huge, bulky head, chest, torso, passes through a window, but its tiny little tail won't pass through. Why? And the commentary to that said, if it passes through, the whole ox and the tail, it falls into a ditch. If it doesn't pass through, it's destroyed. But isn't the point to pass through? Aren't we trying to cross over to the other shore? Why, if it passes through, does it fall into a ditch? And if it doesn't, it's destroyed. What now? Master Sancheng once asked, Sancheng asked Zhui Fang, his teacher, the golden fish that's passed through the net, what does it use for food? This is the image, metaphor for an enlightened being. A golden fish passes through the net, no longer caught. Now, what does it use for food? And Zhui Fang said, I'll tell you when you come out of the net. I mentioned the koan the other day, an ascetic who is pure and undefiled will not enter nirvana. A monastic who breaks the precepts will not fall into hell. This is one of the ways in which the koans and many religious teachings can be so powerful because they startle us, right? They do not conform to our idea of how things work. In fact, they seem to often contradict it directly. So are these, is that statement contradicting Nagarjuna, Dogen? It's so difficult to not assume a self. It's just kind of automatic. And even as we are within the practice of the Dharma, having faith in selflessness, practicing to realize that, bringing those words to our mouth every day, in the midst of that, we continually assume that there is a self. It reveals itself in our language all the time. It's just so strong. If enlightened beings are not free of causation, then how are they? Can they be liberated? How can we be liberated? I spoke about this the other day. Is it just a matter of mitigation, diminishing? That's not what the Buddha was looking for. That's not what he realized. Is being turned into a fox punishment for the wrong answer? If it's wrong, is wrong, then there is no freedom. If he's right, then it seems to contradict all these other teachings, having deep faith in causation. Dogen says, do not try and avoid this. Do not try and get away from this. Is there a path beyond right and wrong? Is there a path beyond passing through and not passing through? Not blind to cause and effect, not confused by it, not ignorant of it. When we realize the self is empty, all the constituent aspects of the self are empty, everything we give rise to, every action, every gift, everything received, Do we stop eating, bathing, practicing, cleaning our room, feeling pain? When an ordinary person realizes it, they become an enlightened being. When an enlightened being realizes it, they become an ordinary person. All of this is pointing to the basic point. All of these teachings have everything to do with not falling, not ignoring. Not falling, not ignoring have everything to do with the basic point. That's why when we practice and we sit, we don't sit and try to, you know, dig up all of our history. Okay, let's deal with it. One by one. So every one of our actions, every one of our memories, every one of our, they line up in a queue. You can't even see the end. Right? You got to deal with each one of them. We don't do that. I hope you're not doing that. You just sit. You wait. And if the mind is receptive, if we're practicing, alert and relaxed. Because even if our mind, even if we think, I am open and receptive, the body can be saying, no way, baby. It's not coming in. That's why it's not just a matter of comfort and ease in meditation, but it's ease. It's opening doors and windows. And if we just sit, and with some courage, for whatever, for whenever you might need it, then whatever arises, it arises because this is the time. This is the time when that past action has ripened into this moment. That doesn't mean you will think it is the right moment, or that you are ready, or that you are ripened for this, but that's just our opinion. What is the middle way that, even to say, goes beyond all apparent opposites? See, this is where language just, you know, it's like, that doesn't. The language is, we got to use it, right? It's what we got. But its whole standard is essentially the standard of dualities. It functions in the world of it. It functions in the world of things. It functions to make things clear between a subject and an object. It functions to define, to describe, to limit, to add certainty, to know. In working in the Bodhisattva path, there are lots of books, but there's no essential book. There's no book for you, like your operating manual, right? So you won't run into a particular kind of jam, just look in the index, it'll be there, turn to page 24. In the event that this might happen to you, this is what you do. You're the book. It's being written, which means we have to find our way. We have to take refuge. Years ago, when I was very active in the prison work, I was at the prison in Green Haven, and we were doing Zazen Kai, and one of the students told me that somebody had recently stolen his radio. I said, okay. And he said, well, you know, according to prison law, I have to deal with this. And I said, what does that mean? He said, I have to go get it, and then I have to teach this person a lesson. I said, what does that mean? He said, you are not going to do this again, and I'm going to make you suffer so that you don't do it again. And I have to do that for that person also to communicate to everybody, don't mess with me. And I said, okay. I said, what about that rocks that are hanging around your neck? And he said, but if I don't do that, then everyone will think I'm weak. I said, are you weak? And I didn't mean physically. I mean, that was clear. He's not weak. But I said, are you weak in your heart? And he said, no. He said, I don't really even care about the radio. He said, I just don't want to become prey. And I said, okay, well, I'm not going to try and tell you what to do. I can't do that, right? You're, in a sense, the expert here. You're the one who's taken vows. But understand that in this path, sometimes you have to stand alone. You have to go a different way and find out, because if you don't do that, you'll never know if there's another way. We'll just keep doing the same old thing, assuming that is the only truth there is. Some weeks later, when I was back, I saw him again. And I said, what happened to that radio? And he said, well, I went to the guy, because he knew he had done it. And the guy was prepared for a fight. And this student said, look, I know you took my radio. He said, I make a gift of it to you. I want you to have it. And then he walked away. And I said, what happened next? And he thought for a minute, he goes, nothing. I said, you told me that if you did that, you would become prey. And he goes, yeah. I said, why do you think this played out the way it did? He goes, I don't know. And I said, when you went to talk to him, were you afraid? He said, no. I said, think about that. What were you communicating beyond your words? Living 500 happy, blessed lives as a fox. In one moment, an enlightened being does not fall into causation. In the next moment, living 500 years as a fox. 3 months left at a job you hate, transform that hatred. I remember also at Green Haven many years ago, there were two of the main key members of the Sangha, very powerful people. I don't mean they were physically strong, but I mean just powerful as people. They could have done anything in the world if they'd grown up a little bit differently. And they were fighting with each other. And it was a long, simmering, festering feud that was affecting the whole Sangha. And I was there with Dada Roshi. He was, I think, doing a Zazen Kai something. He was giving a talk, probably something about atonement or the precepts or something like that. And during the middle of this talk, and one of the sort of rules I was told once while I was there was, in prison, you never show your sweat. Which means if you're afraid, if you're nervous, you do not show that. Right? It's sort of a hyper sort of, you know, idea of masculinity. And in the middle of this talk, one of the two got up, walked across the Zendo. He was shaking. I remember that. He was shaking. There's a big man. And he walked across to the directly standing in front of this other person. And I thought, okay, what's happening? Be ready for anything. And he started doing prostrations. Then he turned around, walked, and sat down. And Dada Roshi just watched and then continued. It spoke so completely. And that in that place, at that time, to be so vulnerable, willing to make the first move. If we want the currents in our life to shift, they will. That's their nature. Then why is it that sometimes things seem so intractable? Because they're strong? Because they're deep? Because there are things we don't yet understand? Because we can gain more skillfulness? So that we can develop patience and compassion? so that we can understand ourselves. As I've mentioned, I, along with Shoban, who's sitting in Tongariro Monitor today, have been collecting narratives, really, he's been collecting them, interviewing some of the Sangha members who were here at the very, very beginning. Because I wanted to capture, doesn't have a title yet, this unpublished work, but I think I said something, some title, and then it's an informal, incomplete narrative of Zen Mountain Monastery. Because I wanted to be clear, this is not, I wanted to be clear, this is not definitive. This is just a collection of remembrances. So that, because when I first came here, late 84, early 85, I had no idea what had happened before me. I walked in, it was like, oh, it's this. It's just this. You know, I guess it's always been like that. I didn't know who had come before me. I didn't know what had been gone through. I didn't know anything. I just took it at face value. Oh, this is Zen Mountain Monastery. And so I figured, naturally, that's probably what people do. There's nothing wrong with that, but I thought I wanted to find a way to convey for all of us, particularly new folks coming in or newer, to have a sense of this living organism. I wanted to read just a little bit, give you a little taste. This is from Yushin, Dada Roshi's wife at the time, who came here, and we should do endless bows to her because she was so important in the beginning. When they first arrived, she said, we got out and walked up the driveway. She held Asian's hand, Dada, their child. As we got closer to the building, my seven-year-old boy broke away and ran around to the left side. She was preoccupied with him, so she couldn't really look at the monastery. Then she grabbed his hand and they went to the front door. It was locked or stuck. They couldn't get in. He tried to get in through one of the windows. She said, most of the windows were broken. And she said, no, don't do that. We can't go in. So then they came around the east side. And Dida was down there, and they saw the Christ figure. And remember that Dada Roshi grew up Catholic, left the church. And he stood there and he said, look at this. What is this place? She said he looked pale, took a few breaths. There were tears in his eyes. He held on to the blue stone. Just imagine that. The first time they went inside, the next visit, she said, they pushed open the massive front door with its ornate sculpted hinges and stepped inside. Scary. The light bulbs were mostly burned out. The place was filthy. The dining room was a mass of broken tables, benches, chairs. There was a terrible odor. A combination of sewage and sweat. I could hardly step into the kitchen. The last people to use it had left a pile of pots and pans and dishes in the sink. Dried out bubble gum was stuck everywhere. That bubble gum was still here when I came. In fact, it was a series of caretaking tasks to scrape it off. Under tables, on the benches, on the walls, left behind by many of the decades of young campers. Then they went upstairs and saw what is now the Zendo. It had 30 pews along the sides, like that one in the back. That's the one remaining. No altar, just some candles on a table. But Dido saw it as our future Zendo for sure. They moved into the what we used to call the parsonage, the former Jizo house, which David, his son, one of his sons who came here, said was so unbelievably disgusting. Like, he couldn't believe what had happened here to make this place look like this. She said, but there was no heat. They had a little wood stove. I think she said there wasn't even electricity. She said Dido drank camp-style coffee, that's for sure. Boiled on the wood stove, smoked cigarettes, yeah, that's for sure. As he wrote out our schedule on a pad of paper, the daily schedule, she said the same one we follow today, almost 45 years later. She said Zazen was paramount to Dido, and we sat every day and held a short service, even when there were only a few of us in the freezing main hall. There were electric heaters, but the electric heat was so unbelievably expensive that they rarely used them. We wore coats and hats and gloves when we sat and burned everything we could in the fireplace in the dining hall. David, Dada Roshi's son, who's about my age, said, I remember, he came here and spent about a year here. He was a cook. He did whatever needed to be done. He's a beautiful guy. He said, I remember that first winter. We'd be sitting in the Zendo. Yushin would sit with us and then take off to make dinner, be with Asian, and just be Dido and me sitting, him and his father. It wasn't unusual that first winter that it would just be the first of us sitting in the Zendo. Dido emphasized the schedule and we followed it. I don't think I realized at the time how important that was, but the schedule, in a sense, held the place together. Dido's attitude was, I don't care if there's nobody in the Zendo but me. We sit. An action, an intention, sincerity, commitment, perseverance, faith. But these need to be grounded, right? They're not just abstract, kind of floaty, let's feel good about these things. What are they grounded in? They're grounded in the three treasures. They're grounded in the teachings. Most importantly, they're grounded in you, in your body and mind, in your living experience. And there's nothing flighty about them. It's like food. They're like air. They're the stuff we rely upon. And they grow. That's the thing. No roots, no branches, no place they can be found, but they do grow. These virtues. So, Dada Roshi in no small way did all of that for today. Make no mistake. He was thinking about the future beyond him. When we could not even hear his words, we would just go, ma, 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 ma. When he would be talking about the day when he was no longer here. You're like, no, I cannot even think about that. But he was. That's love. That's devotion. That's love for the Dharma, love for the Sangha here, the Sangha to come. And so that schedule, those people sitting in this Zendo, they did what needed to be done at their time. We do what we need to do at our time. That's what we've been given. That's what we give. What could be better?
Thank you for listening. To find out more about ZMM's programs, retreats, and residency, please visit us online at zmm.org.